Andy, welcome to our first Boxfish podcast and the first episode. The purpose of these is we're going to be doing probably quarterly podcasts where we're going to be taking a business leader, security leader, or investor in the cybersecurity space and get to know a little bit about their journey, some pearls of wisdom they can share along the way, and kind of any guidance for people starting out in the industry.
Sounds great.
Andy Dancer, non-exec chairman and investor in Boxfish. I would say you firmly fit investor profile, tech leader, and business leader. And if you remember February, I think it was this year, you and I met down in Woodstock for a curry and a couple of beers.
Yep.
We put the world to right. We covered tech, our journey, your journey, the changing landscape of cyber, even some military defense stuff we ended up on, but we'll ignore that for today. The brief I've had from our marketing team is we need to recreate that conversation, this time on camera, recorded. So let's put the world to right again, and we'll start off by getting to know a little bit about who Andy Dancer is.
I stumbled into cybersecurity in 2003. My third startup actually was a spin out from Bristol University doing email encryption.
Yeah.
And I ran that for 5 years before we sold it to Trend Micro. And I then spent another 5 years at Trend Micro doing various different things. But some people have heard of Trend Micro, some won't. They're actually a billion-dollar cybersecurity company. I don't know if it's still true. When I was there, the rumor was always that in Japan, we had better brand recognition than Microsoft did. So in Japan, McAfee and Symantec would say, we're that security company a bit like Trend Micro.
Yeah.
Perhaps the reverse applies in some other countries, but a really good sort of grounding on cyber there. And I've been lucky enough since to do non-exec work with two cybersecurity consultancies, and now this piece with Boxfish looking at security awareness training. So I've sort of dabbled in and out of cyber for the last 20 plus years and watched it evolve.
And in terms of, I suppose, your journey, so from memory, Trend Micro, are they a PLC business?
Yep, they are. They're actually floated on the Tokyo Stock Exchange, hence the brand recognition in Japan.
So you've gone from grad, building a business, scaling a business, exiting a business, and then CTO at Trend Micro for EMEA.
Yep.
Talk us through a little bit about, I suppose, the journey from young Andy building the business through to scaling that into a PLC business. Just a few highlights, if you will.
When I first joined the email encryption company in Bristol, I say it was a university spin out, and they'd invented a really cool algorithm. Mm-hmm. And they got a little bit of funding, they'd started a business, and they'd employed a consultant to help with the business. And the consultant had written an office procedures manual, he'd rented some office space, spent about half the money that the business had got to start, mm-hmm. and had no idea what the company was actually going to do or what it was going to sell. Mm-hmm. And they contacted me and said, look, you've got a master's degree, so you probably understand, you know, this algorithm that we've got.
Yeah.
And you've done a couple of startups and exited them, so can you come and help us? And I did that part-time, literally from employee number one. We had one other chap who'd come with the university, right through to the point, say, where we exited the business to Trend. But as we exited, we were perhaps 10 people. Mm-hmm. So a very big difference going from there through to a company with 5,000 plus employees worldwide,
yeah.
where there are processes, procedures, policies, things that you do. And yet, actually, I was really lucky with Trend Micro because they were a very entrepreneurial company. So I did an internal startup while I was there, a cloud security product. Mm-hmm. I spoke at the first conference for the Cloud Security Alliance and at RSA and InfoSec and all of the sort of big gigs, really helping to put Trend Micro onto the cloud security map at the time.
And was that quite kind of early in that journey of kind of cloud security?
Yeah, very, very much so. It was just at the point when everything was starting to switch over. So silly little sort of anecdotes. I remember they passed a law in the US, it might have been just California, but about whole disk encryption and mandating that certain data had to be protected by whole disk encryption, just as everybody was moving to the cloud.
Right.
And of course, the concept of now this is your disk and you encrypt the whole of your disk doesn't apply because it's shared disks in a data center.
Yeah.
And we were always patting ourselves on the back in the UK back then with how clever the UK data protection legislation was, because it was written originally for filing cabinets, for how you had to, and it was all about appropriate protection for the level of confidentiality and security the data needed.
Right.
And it's written for filing cabinets, but applied brilliantly to computers as they came along and was still valid with cloud.
Yeah.
And it was a great example of regulators writing things the right way that then allowed innovation.
Yes.
And the product I did internally within Trend Micro was a product that was about encrypting your data in the cloud so that you could move from one cloud provider to another without leaving a digital footprint.
Yes.
So that you didn't then have the problem where all of your data was still sitting in a provider that you were no longer working with. But the data protection legislation from 20 plus years beforehand covered it brilliantly.
Right.
And that was a really, it made me think very hard about how you should write the stuff to try and encourage innovation while still giving the protection you need, not being too prescriptive.
And there's probably not many examples in tech and business where something written 20, 30 years ago is actually almost as relevant today, or at least sets up the foundations for today, and obviously it's iterated. But there's a quote that I remember you saying, which is everything changes but nothing does, which probably leads us quite nicely on to your view on cyber and kind of the fundamentals. So unpack that kind of quote for me, if you don't mind.
So I remember that from when we had the conversation in Woodstock. So I think if you watch what's happened, and I've seen cyber, say, from being involved as a sort of founder entrepreneur through to angel investing in various businesses, seeing a lot of businesses coming for investment. And what happens is that cybersecurity remains a kind of adversarial game. You've got good guys and bad guys, attackers and defenders. Mm-hmm. It's the classic terrorist thing where the defenders have to win every time and the attackers only have to win once. As a new technology comes along, it can do quite well early on. You get a new technology, it's under the radar of the bad guys, but it's able to see what the bad guys are doing. It offers protection against the latest threat. Everybody thinks, fantastic, we've now found the next silver bullet, comes out for investment. But then it raises its profile and the bad guys become aware and they start fighting back.
Like an arms race almost.
Exactly. Yeah. And suddenly that really effective technology isn't so effective anymore and something else comes along.
Yeah.
And so you go through this sort of cycle where the technology that you need to protect evolves. Mm-hmm. If you look at the, again, very old sort of staid analogy, but I think still holds really well. If you imagine the traditional castle and you have your sort of big open expanse in front of it where you can see people approaching for several miles, and then you've got a moat and you've got some walls and you've got an inner keep and you've got lots of different layers. Mm-hmm. And that principle has been applied to security for a long while, that you have to have multiple layers of defense and multiple layers of protection. It's relatively easy for the bad guys to work their way through any one layer. It's harder to work through several layers. And by the time you've got lots of layers and you can't even see what the inner layers are until you've worked your way through the outer layers, that's generally the best way to protect yourself. And over time, the layers have changed. The right technology, the right techniques to use at each layer have changed. But it's still basically multiple layers of protection. Mm-hmm. It starts with technology. And you need technology to weed out as much as you can. Mm-hmm. There will always be some stuff that gets through to the human being at the end. And that, of course, as you know only too well, running a security awareness business is where the human factor comes in. That once stuff makes its way past those layers, however good they are, you have to assume at some point it will.
So we're like the final guard in the inner keep. If
Correct.
Using that analogy.
Exactly on that analogy. Yeah. And so training the people to then recognize, actually, this has made it through is the last line of defense.
Yeah.
And it always has to be in place.
And I suppose that leads us quite nicely on to, I suppose, the profile of cyber within any size organization. But let's talk specifically mid-market for now. So I'm a on the board, mid-market organization. Obviously, I really like that analogy. First time I've heard it, actually, I think it works really well. How would you raise the profile of the need to build the defenses? So build your walls, dig your moat deeper, your portcullis or whatever. I'm not that good at medieval history, but the concept being the same. How would you go about having those conversations? Because obviously you've got all the business stakeholders fighting for their own. Yeah, I need more money for sales, more money for marketing, finance systems. How would you put that on the board's agenda?
A lot of the problem, I think, is that the cyber stuff seems complicated and it's not well understood.
Yeah.
And people generally shy away from the things that they don't understand so well. So I think it's about trying to simplify it for people. Mm-hmm. Although it's really complicated, there's a temptation because you know when something to do with your job is really complicated and you're deep in the weeds and the detail of it, you sort of feel like everybody else has to be. But actually, that's your job to be deep in the weeds, and your job is to bring it out for them. So I think there were two things. Firstly, talking to people in terms that they can relate to. I remember we did something years ago trying to train people, and we couldn't get their motivation to learn. So we started talking to them about keeping their kids safe rather than keeping them safe.
Yeah.
And actually, the message was the same. It was all about how you protect yourself online and what you looked out for and so on. And actually, at the end, some of them were brave enough to say, do you know, I thought I knew all about this stuff, and I've learned loads today. And I wouldn't have come, but I thought I should learn about how to look after my kids. So that,
well, teaching reminds you of the best practice, doesn't it?
It does.
A good way of bringing that memory back.
Yeah. And actually, if you do go home and teach your kids, of course, it becomes ingrained then. Once you've taught something to somebody, you kind of never forget it yourself. So that works quite well. So that's one angle. The other one is trying to move it away from cyber specifically and into something, particularly at board level, that people understand, generic risk.
Yes.
It's not about cyber threat. It's about risk.
Yeah.
And it's about the right amount to spend to protect yourself from that risk.
Yes.
And you can never eliminate the risk.
No.
It doesn't matter how much you spend. You can reduce the risk, and eventually you reach a point of diminishing returns where you've probably spent enough. But how do you work that out relative to the other priorities in the business? The risk of the office burning down or the market collapsing. All of those are potential threats to the business. Finally, I think the other thing is just bringing it home to people from a personal perspective. We've all seen clips of CEOs on 24-hour news channels when things have gone wrong.
Yes.
Scrabbling because they're suddenly in front of the camera and they just don't know. They don't know enough of the detail to be able to answer the questions. They haven't understood what's going on. Often it's very early in the cycle of the problem breaking.
Yeah.
And even their experts in the business don't know what's going on.
Yes.
But as a CEO, you are a CEO, you're used to your team expect you to have the answer to everything.
Yes.
And so you're there on camera and your whole demeanor is, I should know the answer.
Yeah.
And actually I don't.
Yes.
So helping prepare that it's normal in a cyber incident, that early on you don't know all the answers, but what are the things that you should be doing? What can you plan in advance for? Our first message that goes out is going to be like this. It's a holding message that says we're aware, we're investigating, we've got the right experts in. That sort of response is also part of it that goes alongside the prevention.
What I've certainly seen over the last kind of few years is there's a bit more forgiveness probably from the consumer that, or my supplier, my vendor, a company I work with has had a cyber attack, I think, because nobody wants it to happen to anybody. And fundamentally, there is that point of diminishing returns where there is only an amount of spend you can associate, regardless of size of organisation, to defending against cybercrime. But I think it's a bit like the dirty laundry. You might have to air it at some point. So what you want to do is make sure, was that business kind of doing the right things for that size of organisation? And I think that for me is a big thing. So have you got the fundamentals in place? Are you including product, people, processes? Or was it just they put their head in the sand, thought it would never happen to them, and they left a huge open door? So I think it's finding that balance of doing the right things for where you are in your organisation cycle and investing the right amount, but without going OTT, because there isn't a silver bullet.
I think you're right. It's remarkable. Back to that, everything changes, but nothing does. A lot of the basics stay true for a long, long while. So movers, leavers, joiners, or
classic,
I should say it the other way around. Door. JML is the acronym. So joiners, movers, leavers. But a lot of it is somebody's left the business and their account hasn't been shut down and it's still open.
Yeah.
That's not sophisticated or difficult, but it is process, has to be done. A lot of the stuff that companies still fall foul of is spray and pray attacks. It's not specifically targeted at them. It's just a numbers game. Throw stuff out there randomly to hundreds of thousands of users, a small percentage click on it and you win.
Yeah.
That's the stuff you can defend against.
Yes.
The stuff that's harder, of course, is the really targeted attacks. If somebody is specifically going after your business, then you come down to the analogy with the tiger and the trainers, if you know that one, where people use it in slightly different guises, but it goes along the lines of two people were walking in a jungle and they saw a tiger and one of them stopped and took his trainers out of his rucksack and put his trainers on. And his friend stopped and looked at him and said, "You're being stupid. You can't outrun a tiger just because you put your trainers on." He says, "I don't need to. I just need to outrun you."
Yeah.
And with some of this, sad to say, but actually the security of your business is not about making it perfect. It's about making yourself a harder target than some of the other businesses around you to keep your business safe.
Yeah.
That's the sort of individual responsibility. I think as business leaders, though, we should all carry a corporate responsibility.
Yeah.
This is particularly relevant now with ransomware coming up.
Yeah, it's
good. Where from an individual company, it may well be that the economically sensible thing for you if you've been hit with ransomware is to pay the fine.
Yeah.
But from a overall marketplace perspective, the more businesses that pay the fine
funds
the next attack, and the next attack may well come back to you anyway, and we all have a bit of a responsibility as a community to not pay the fine, give in to terrorism, which is the, you know, it's the electronic equivalent of that, but to actually look out for the community and make sure that we keep the appropriate measures in place so that we don't have to pay the fine and we can restore the data and get the business back operating again.
A lot of these things are really easy to discuss, obviously, in a podcast scenario, but when it's your business, so there's somebody that, they'll remain nameless, but I had a conversation with about a year ago, they third generation furniture maker, local to where I live, about 50 staff, and they had a ransomware attack, and I was chatting to the current MD, and like, you know, I just didn't think they'd target us. You know, we make cabinets and kitchens and bespoke office furniture. It's like, well, just because you haven't got a ton of, I suppose, really confidential information, but you've got CAD designs, you've got systems, you've got your old company data, your orders. And they just went and did a ransomware, and I think they did end up funding the ransom, actually. But they were, it was just like, I just never saw it happening. And I was like, I think the reality is the media are doing a great job at highlighting cyber's real. It can happen. But obviously, it's very rare the family-run 30, 40, 50-employee business it makes that kind of headline coverage. So there's almost an element, I think, where we could do a bit better to educate the board that run SMB businesses that it is real. And they're not always targeting the banks or the tax offices, you know, et cetera, or the, you know, big investment houses, that it can happen. And often the ramifications, I would say, are more personal at that size because it's, you know, you're paying people's wages that fund their mortgage, their rent, their holidays, their children's swimming lessons, etc., you know, versus a billion-dollar bank that is probably insured up to the...
I think you're right. I mean, at that size of business, the employees are almost an extension to your family. You know,
they shut the business down in the short term. They shut the business down for 3 weeks while they got things back on track.
Yeah, and I think... Again, if you look at the motivation behind some of the cybercrime, there is a money motivation and a political motivation.
Yes.
And so some businesses are naturally higher targets or higher risk targets because they're working in certain areas, whatever it might be. It might be a animal testing business. It might be something with geopolitical ramifications and might be nation state sponsored stuff. Some of it is just pure organized crime going after cash.
Yes.
It's the modern version of the mafia controlling the thing. And so in that situation, it's any business which makes themselves an easy target by not having enough layers and enough walls and not getting their final line of defense right. It's worrying for businesses because often the banking regulations don't protect businesses as well as they do individuals. So if you're an individual and you're a victim of crime, it's easier to get your money back than if you're a business and you're a victim of crime. People often think that the protection businesses have is because they have multiple signatories on the account and that protects them. But there have been some really worrying examples where somebody may have sent a PDF document to somebody which is loaded with a particular attack, but it appears not to open correctly. And that single email, somebody's tried to open it, their machine's been compromised, they forwarded it to somebody else saying, "I can't open this, can you?" And that one email actually gets both of the signatories on the account in one go.
So obviously, looking at the different motivations of cyber criminals, we've got, you know, going after data, money. One thing that really I suppose, is close to our heart. We do a lot of work in education. I think about 1,000 schools, or more than 1,000 schools throughout the UK, is when you hear of cyber criminals and gangs targeting schools, particularly around quite emotional events, things like results days and you know, taking student coursework and things like that. And I think something that just really grinds my gears, that it is so directly impacting families and students when you are taking their work or locking systems down so they can't reveal results and scoring. It's just that they're such nasty individuals, aren't they? Really, yeah. Are. And one of the things that we're hosting a series on in about 2 weeks' time is we're going to be working with some, I suppose, IT leaders within education around how they're raising the profile of cyber good practice, not just a trustee and board, I suppose, that they couldn't at their board level, but within the staff community, but also students and parents. So trying to almost start that, you know, I refer to it as more skills for life. So this isn't workplace learning, what we do, and I don't want to plug Boxfish because it's not kind of directly to that, but more that these are fundamental skills that you need to know in terms of how to spot these PDFs, the emails, how to set and manage good passwords. You need to know at any age, within reason. You know, I've got a four-year-old daughter and she is very good on the tablet, you know, navigating a way around and thinking, like, you know, at best I was scribbling with wax crayons at that point, and she's already navigating a way around a tablet. So within a few years, she will have a profile, there'll be passwords, there'll be people that you've got to be careful of. So how would you go about, back to the, I suppose, the mid-market analogy, and you've done some great analogies today, raising that profile of cyber all the way, so we've talked about the board level, what about all the way through the business?
You described that really well in terms of the kind of the life skills that people need. One of the things that differentiates cyber from almost any other form of crime is that you at no point need to be present in the country where you're committing the crime. Yeah. If you want to rob somebody, ultimately you have to go and hold them up or visit their house or whatever it might be. And when we were younger, the sort of things that we were learning are, you know, don't walk down a dark alley by yourself at night, yeah, and so on, in order to protect yourself from crime. How do you limit your exposure and how do you protect yourself? I think a lot of it is about bringing those real world analogies through to people in cyber, because stuff can happen so fast in the online world, and without you seeing it happening, it's easier to sort of put your head in the sand and pretend it's not there. So with the online stuff, actually, when my kids, they're a couple of them are grown up now, one's still perhaps in the process of growing up. Maybe we all carry on growing up for life. But the two of them went to a thing that the local fire station did in Oxford, actually. And they did a whole series of things with the kids. They had somebody who was injured on the road, and what were they going to do? Mm-hmm. And then they marked them on, did they run out into the road without looking to try and help the person who had been hit and get run over themselves? Or did they call for an ambulance? They had a room where they suddenly set smoke in it. And did anybody actually check that everybody had made it out of the room?
Yeah.
And at the end of it, they said to them, brilliant. Now, while you've been doing this, there's another school up in Yorkshire who've been doing the same thing in their fire station. Would you like to, you know, have a little chat with them online about the experience?
Yeah.
They sat them down at a computer and they chatted away, and they were, you know, asking all sorts of things about, you know, where are you from and so on. And then halfway through the conversation, a door opened to the side and the big burly bearded fireman who was actually on the other end of the chat came in to say, so, you know, you'd be so-and-so and you live here and this is all the information actually just given me online, because it wasn't a school in Yorkshire you were talking to, it was me. And and they set it up for them brilliantly and showed them. And my kids still remember it now, kind of 15 years on. If you can try and join that real world to the physical world, I think that's when it's when our barriers naturally break down. Actually, I'll come back to that in a sec maybe, but two, it's how you then help people realize what they need to do.
Yes.
So as much as possible, trying to talk to people about, if a conman, you know, if somebody you didn't know came up and said, oh, can I just have your bank PIN, because I'm doing a survey on what combinations of numbers people use for their bank PINs. So, you know, can I just take yours from my list? You wouldn't say, oh, sure, mate, this is what it is. You'd say, no, I'm not telling you my bank PIN. So why, when somebody randomly rings you up and says, hi, I'm from your bank, can you just give me your PIN number to check that it's, you know, you're who you say you are? Why do you give the information? Equally, I always think, why do the banks ever ring you and ask you to go through security? They should surely send you a message that says, please ring our main switchboard number from the number on your, you know, card, well, and give them this code to recognise the call. They're training bad behaviour by doing it.
They have got better, though. So Halifax have sent some things and communications where they're like, this is how to spot fraud, and we will never ring you and ask you questions. And I think there's an element of that communication that don't provoke and encourage the bad habits. And one of the things that obviously we do with the Boxfish hats, I suppose, is the simulated cyber attacks. And going back to that, almost showing and immersing people in what they actually are. So whether that's your children with the room next door oversharing information, which is fundamentally kind of, I suppose, what they were trying to tease out there. It's a bit of a thankless task, the simulations. I think if they're positioned poorly, they can do more harm than good. But I think the reality is, of you are exposing people to what a cyber attack looks like in a safe environment. Yes. And there is an element of, it's that exposure therapy of, that's how an account takeover looks like. Unfortunately, this time you've put in your credentials to Microsoft. Now we have got systems that would probably prevent an account takeover, but the starting point of account takeover was that, look out for these 3-4 things next time. And I think there's an element of, you've got to put people in it so they know what the real stuff looks like.
I think you're absolutely right. And you have to simulate and get close to it. It's the, again, back to those sort of old analogies, but the only way to be 100% safe with your information is to physically lock it in a safe and never connect it to a network. But you can't do anything.
Business. Yeah.
So you have to take a certain amount of risk. So you have to learn how to do it. You have to go out of the house and walk about. And when you do, you expose yourself to crime at a certain level that may happen.
Yeah,
and so understanding how to reduce your risk is a good thing.
Yeah.
The same when you go and engage in the digital world.
One of the things that they're so intertwined now, the work, personal, house, office, it's all, you know, one beast really, is that the stuff that you can do to learn the good cyber practices, raise the profile, are equally as important when you're at home on a weekend as they are when you're connected to a network at home. I think one that I did a talk about a year ago around different cyber attacks, and I actually picked a couple of things start to finish, so how it started, where it ended. And there was one that sits with me, which I think is useful for me to share in this podcast, where you remember in COVID, Amazon went, I mean, it's mental all the time, certainly in our household anyway, but it was crazy in COVID, people just doing loads of online shopping. And there was a gang that had downloaded some or made some QR codes that linked to a fake Amazon login page. And they put them through people's letterboxes saying, you've been recognised as one of our top shoppers or whatever. Scan this QR code to get a surprise credit applied to your account. And what it was doing is it was logging you into a fake Amazon login page, obviously revealing usernames and passwords, and they were gathering all that data. And I actually had one of the leaflets as well. I managed to get a copy online and print it off, and I gave it round to the audience in the event and said, this is the kind of stuff. And, you know, it's but you wind that back to raising the profile of cyber in an organization. Well, if we said, look, QR codes generally are pretty dangerous, giving your information away into sites that aren't quite real, the branding's not quite there, all the domain's a bit strange, would have stopped. And I don't know how many people fell victim to that, but the concept of, you wouldn't have even scanned it, you would have put it straight in the bin, off you go.
Yeah.
And I think it's that time between the two now is so critical.
I think you're absolutely right. That relationship between the online world and digital world, we tend to think they're completely separate. When you join the two together, it breaks the barrier down. The bit I said perhaps I'd come back to is I did a talk some years ago, actually at one of the security events, talking to people about that physical and real world thing. And I had two members of the audience kind of in the front row. And I said, so imagine, Jim, that Fred, who's sitting next to you, pinged you after the event with a LinkedIn invitation and said, I sat next to you, you know, on the front row in that Andy Dancers presentation.
Yes.
You know, we should connect. All of a sudden at that point, you would probably at least click on the link to think, oh, do I recognize the guy? You know, you'd had a bit of a conversation. And at that point, I've now made you click a link. And that's actually all I need to do is get you to follow a chosen link in order to be able to potentially put a 0-day threat onto your machine that your software is not blocking, and I've now hijacked your machine.
Yeah.
The funny spin-off to that story was they were recording the session, And the cameraman came up to me afterwards, very embarrassed, and said, I'm really sorry, but I ran out of battery halfway through recording that. Is there any way you could do it again? And I said, well, what about the bit where I talk to the audience?
Yeah.
And he said, no problem at all. I haven't got the audience in. The camera shot's coming above the heads of the audience. So just do it again and nobody will know. So I had to then stand and do my half hour spiel again for the camera, including this fake interaction with two people that weren't sitting in front of me in the audience. And I've never looked back to see whether he did the dirty on me and just zoomed out while I was doing that bit.
An empty room.
Had me talking to two empty chairs or not. Yeah, well, I hope these mics are on because, we don't want to have to go through all that again. So, we're going to move to a quick fire round. And there's three questions and a little bonus question. So, one of the things that I'm really excited about Boxfish is we've recently just appointed our first graduate, kind of a graduate developer program, which is something we'll probably look to do on an annual basis. You've gone through that track and we started, you know, at the very beginning of the episode about leaving uni, going through various jobs, scaling business, exiting, CTO, almost, you know, if you're a developer or somebody starting out in cyber, I imagine the pinnacle for most is I want to be a CTO of X firm. What advice would you give to whether that be somebody in today's world or yourself 20 years ago that's starting out kind of quite early on in their journey?
Great question. I think two bits perhaps to answer that. The first thing is, I think don't be too over prescriptive in terms of follow your nose.
Yeah.
So find a job you love is the first thing that's most important. If you love what you're doing and you're passionate about it and you turn up every day and you want to do it and you go home and actually you can find something where you're still thinking about it afterwards. And some people might say, oh, that's horrible and it's your work invading. Actually, it's not if you love doing it. It's what you love doing.
Yeah.
That's the first thing, is that above all else. I think it's really hard to plot a career path. Some people do, and in some jobs you can, I guess, if you become a doctor. No expert, but you know, there are various
different levels
and you work your way from this one to this one to this one, and there's a kind of path laid out, and at some point you become a consultant and off you go. My career path hasn't been like that at all, and I never knew from one job to the next what the next thing was going to be. You mentioned student. When I was at university, I was lucky enough to live in a house for 3 years with a chap called Ian Levy. And Ian, you may recognize the name, ended up as the first sort of founding technical director of the National Cybersecurity Center.
Yeah.
He went through a completely different career path to me. He ended up, I think he did a PhD in the end in video compression stuff. And then he went off to work for CESG and came up through the government track. But he's now in private industry at Amazon advising on security stuff.
Yeah.
I started out, my first business was in e-commerce. It was nothing to do with security at all.
Yeah.
And went down a kind of business startup route, then happened to end up in security because the third business I did, the Bristol University one, was security. And we ended up actually with our career paths coming quite close together sort of later on, but started in completely different directions. And I suspect neither of us actually, certainly when we were having lots of conversations at university, neither of us were perhaps envisaging the route that either of us went down.
Yeah.
So my advice is actually follow your nose, do something you love. And if you do that, you'll do it well and you'll enjoy what you do along the way.
Yeah, so commit basically to what's in front of you. Commit to, to that. Love it, that.
Exactly. And, you know, we've just recently in this business hired a brand new grad, exactly like that, who had committed actually from day one, came to the interview having done a whole website mock-up of the stuff that we were doing, put several days of work, I think, into prep for the interview, and arrived that keen on the first day, and still 2 weeks in, it's early days, is still that keen, and hopefully he's still loving it and we're loving it, and that will work for everybody.
Bring the energy, bring that spark, and I think the critical thing is the preparation. Like, set yourself apart. You know, we spoke with, I was involved with some of the interviewing early on, but you speak with so many people, and then you do that level of preparation, you're head and shoulders apart from the competition, in effect. So great insights, thank you. Okay, moving very quickly on to just three little personal things about you, Andy. So what's your favourite book?
Reach for the Sky
right.
Which is the life story of Douglas Bader, who was a World War II pilot who lost his legs in an airplane crash, went back flying without his legs, was prisoner of war, etc. And I just love it because it's a story of succeeding through adversity, of somebody that never gave up, that saw the positive in the stuff that was going on around them and just got on with it.
I know the story. Excellent, excellent story. I love that. I didn't think you'd choose that. Favourite food?
Favourite food, anything that's a dessert, but actually from a main course, which is how people normally answer it, that question, I would say lasagna. That goes back to when I was a child and I went round to visit some friends with my parents and they had kids. And the adults were eating lasagna and the children ate something else in a different room. And I was kind of halfway between the two. I was older than their kids and they were expecting that I wanted to eat the child menu. And of course, I was, I don't know, 13 or something at that stage and feeling like I was an adult and wanted that lasagna. And I did. And so inevitably I liked it because I decided I was going to like it and it stuck.
Fine. I won't take offense. You didn't say curry with Nick, by the way, but...
Well, obviously, a very close second.
Yeah, and next time we go for dinner, I'll take you to good Italian. Okay, and then final question, tell us something that people wouldn't know about you.
I'm fairly a long way away on the autistic spectrum, which is perhaps not unusual for a techie. My eldest son is further along the spectrum than I am, and I perhaps didn't realise there's a lot more diagnosis these days than there was back then. I perhaps didn't realise when I was younger that's what it was with me. And how many learnt behaviours I have, which aren't necessarily natural or instinctive for me, that I've learnt to do. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, most of the time we've been having this conversation, I've been looking in your direction. In reality, I could stare into the corner over there and have the conversation. It would make no difference to me, but it would make you feel pretty uncomfortable. And so you learn along the way to do that. Maybe that's one of the reasons for my sort of favourite book, is that there are times when the world doesn't necessarily make sense because you don't have that instinctive grasp of how other people think about things.
Yeah.
It was described to my son in one of the schools where they went back in history and looked at a lot of successful people and how many of them they actually think were quite a long way down the autistic spectrum. That actually, if you think the same way as the rest of the world, you conform to it. If you think differently, you change it.
Yes.
And that's kind of stuck with me. So I suppose that's the thing about me, is I'm actually quite a long way down the autistic spectrum. Hopefully a lot of the time people wouldn't necessarily realise. And so that's perhaps a shout out for other people that are, that says kind of just get out and do it.
Thank you very much, Andy. Well, thanks for taking the time. It's been really useful, certainly for me to get to know you better. I hope the audience have picked up a few of your pearls of wisdom. So thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.